Okay, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight. I promise not to be too long-winded. I'm actually used to doing these kind of things in about 10 minutes, so I'm not sure if I can even talk as long as I'm scheduled for. But I'll try. And we'll have plenty of time for the audience. I'm pretty impressed that people have come for this. Washington is not a city known for its intellectual curiosity. And so this is the kind of series. Nobody is being paid to be here. And, you know, most of the time in this town, you have even press conferences and you could say almost anything. And people are always just thinking, well, how can I use this? How can I spin this? But what I've found in these kind of lectures, seminars, discussions is that there's more of an interest in just finding out what's really going on. And that is CEPR's mission, I should say. We have a relatively modest and humble mission just to get out some of the most basic truths that are often ignored and get them into the discussions over economic policy, correct a lot of the mistakes that are out there, mistaken beliefs, and often just point out things that most economists agree or even all economists agree upon, and but nobody's talking about that have enormous importance. So you can find all of this information on our website at cepr.net, including, I guess, the PowerPoint from tonight will be up there with an audio. And anything else you need, you feel free to contact us. So let me start with one of the most obvious truths in the last 25 years, and one that's extremely important, I would say, perhaps even the most important economic phenomenon of the last 25 years, and that's been the long-term economic failure in low- and middle-income countries. Let's see if I can use this. First, I want to say that economic growth is extremely important. It's really what enables people to improve their quality of life, although not all increases in growth correspond to improvement in quality of life. But they really are a kind of a necessary condition in most countries. And this was discussed in seminar two, so I won't go through it again, just to point out that in low and middle income countries, it's even more important than it is in the high income countries. In fact, first of all, if you care about distribution, inequality, or poverty, it's very hard to do anything about these things when there's little or no economic growth, because it means that you will have to take from people in order to improve the position of the bottom quintile, for example, the poor people in the country. If you don't, if the economy is growing, there's at least a chance you can take the new income and make sure that the poor people get a larger share of that new income and wealth, which is hard enough. But if the economy is not growing, you have to actually lower the living standards of people who already have that income and wealth. And that's very hard generally to do without violence or even with violence. And so that's why that's one reason why people who care about economic and social progress do care generally about growth. Now, in terms of what we're talking about, the basic measure we're going to use is gross domestic product, GDP, per capita or per person, which is roughly the same as income per person. And the reason we use per person is because if your economy grows simply because you have more people, that doesn't really make your population better off. So this cancels out the effect of population growth, and what you're really looking at is productivity increases, and in some cases, some increased employment as well. That's raising per capita income over time. Now, income does go up over time, and in fact, over time, you also see, long period of time, you see improvements in health outcomes and education and life expectancy and infant mortality and child mortality and so on. But in order to evaluate what's happened over the past 25 years, you have to have a benchmark. So in other words, if you don't, and this is something a mistake a lot of people make, they just say, well, things are improving. Well, that's not really the question. The question is how much, right? And so in order to have a benchmark, we just compare to previous decades. And you'll see it's a fair comparison that we're making here. First, before I look at the data, just to let you to summarize some of the major economic reforms that have taken place over in the low and middle income countries, which most of you are familiar with, so I'll just run through them briefly. You've had a tremendous reduction in restrictions on international trade and capital flows, not for all goods and services, of course. In some cases, you have increased restriction, and I think that was mentioned earlier in an earlier lecture in terms of goods protected by intellectual property provisions such as pharmaceuticals. Those restrictions have increased, but for a lot of goods and services, you have a reduced restriction on capital flows as well, on investment flows, money across borders. You've tended to have tighter fiscal budget policies, tighter monetary policies, credit, higher interest rates, higher real interest rates. A lot of privatization. You know, in Latin America in just the 1990s, you had more than $178 billion worth of privatization, which, to give you a comparison, was more than 20 times the entire privatization that took place in Russia of their whole, which was basically their whole economy, was state-owned after the collapse of the Soviet Union. You've had labor market reforms and public pension reforms, privatization of social security systems, for example. There was a conscious effort by the World Bank, for example, to support these reforms and privatizations. And in fact, most of these reforms, I should mention, were very much supported by Washington, by the U.S. Treasury Department, by the IMF, the World Bank, other multilateral institutions that the United States is a predominant player. And that's why some people have referred to some of these as Washington consensus. It has a lot of, they have a lot of different names. Liberalization, globalization, neoliberalism is the term that's most popular in Latin America. But the two terms that I won't use for them, I think, you know, I'm going to try labeling them all together just to be objective here, but the two terms I think are wrong and inaccurate are free trade and free market, because as I said, and we'll, this is a major theme of CEPRS, it's economically not true to say that these reforms are overwhelmingly free market or free trade, because they increase some barriers to trade, such as the intellectual property protections. They very often involve more government intervention rather than less, such as the cases of the fixed exchange rates in Russia and Argentina and Brazil, for example, major disasters of the 1990s. Those were the market solution would have been to let the exchange rate float. So you can give a lot of examples, but I think it's a mistake, especially for people who are critical of what has happened over the last 25 years, to accept the marketing terminology of the proponents of the reforms and accept that these are free market or free trade reforms, because very often they're not, and very often the cases in which they involve protectionism, the protectionism is much more costly than the barriers that they're removing from a purely economic point of view. A couple of other reforms, the abandonment of state-directed industrial policies or development strategies. It was very common in the 60s and 70s, even the 50s, for countries that were independent, to have industrial strategies or development strategies, a conscious decision by the government to try to move from low value-added areas of production to higher value-added areas of production, countries building their own steel industries. Even countries as poor as Haiti under the Duvalier dictatorship had an industrial strategy. And so this has largely... not completely, but largely disappeared. The final change has been the increased accumulation of foreign exchange and foreign reserve holdings, because countries have been more, because of the opening up to the global economy, the countries have had to keep more foreign exchange, and that turns out to have a cost as well, and probably contributed to the reduced growth. But right now, we're not really going to try and look at the causality. We just want to make it clear that certain reforms have happened. And in most of the press and the media, these are generally seen as positive. and is having produced positive results. Although not completely, right? There's always an admission that some people have been left behind and things like that. Let me look at the data now and see what happened to growth. Over the last 25 years, there's been a sharp slowdown in economic growth in the vast majority of low and middle income countries. And here's the countries for which there is data divided into quintiles. And what we did here was we just ordered them into quintiles by, in this case, the variable is per capita income per person. So the poorest group at the top you can see is countries that started either the 1960s or the 1980s at a level between income per person between $355 and $1,225. All the way up to the top range, which is between a little over $9,000 and $43,700. Now, the idea here is to see what happens to, you know, all of these groups. And I want to explain, this is probably the only slightly complicated part of this discussion. And that is, we don't want to look at what happens just to the same countries over time. So we don't want to say, okay, here's, you know, five countries, you know, Brazil, India, Argentina, and a couple of others, and say, what happened to them in 1960 to 80, and then what happened to them from 1980 to 2005? Because that would tend to show a slowing down in very many measures, just because it's harder to make the same rate of improvement. Now, it's not always harder in terms of economic growth, but it does get eventually. Certainly, you wouldn't expect the rich countries, for example, to grow as fast as the developing countries. But it's, you know, also in life expectancy. You wouldn't expect it to be as easy to move from average life expectancy of 70 to 75 as to move from 50 to 55. So by saying, okay, you know, if you look on the left side, the blue bars, is that what color they are? That's all the countries that were at this income level in 1960. And then we're comparing to all the countries, again, adjusting for inflation. These are constant dollars in 2,000-year dollars. All the countries that started out in 1980 at that level and say, well, who grew faster, okay, or who progressed more in the other indicators, as we'll see. And so this is a fair comparison. If anything, it really biases it towards finding a better result in the second period, because in the second period, countries are starting out with all kinds of technology and knowledge the world has, at least, and they in principle should have access to some of it, that didn't exist back in 1960. So if anything, we would expect, all of the things being equal without policy changes and other things, we would expect to find a better result in the second period. But as you can see, we find the opposite for growth, a very sharp fall off in growth for all of the four quintiles. The top quintile is not really rich countries, by the way. It's starting at 9,000 per capita. So you have a fall off even there, and it's mainly because of the middle income countries in that quintile. All the way down, the only one you see improvement for is the bottom quintile, and that disappears if you without India and China, for example. And even though India and China in this data set are only counted as one country, they're not counted any more than any tiny little country, okay? Because we're just counting one country as each data point, all right? Every country counts the same. And there's a reason for that, because we're, you know, policy changes were made in a lot of countries. And so we want to know, did they succeed? In how many countries did they succeed overall? Or where did they fail? And assuming that policy had something to do with this. And you can see an enormous drop-off. And just to give you some example, if you look at the quintile second from the bottom, for those who aren't used to dealing with growth rates, so you have a fall-off between 2.4% growth in the first period to 0.7% in the second period. And that makes a difference The difference in those two rates of growth is the difference between doubling your income per person in 30 years versus doubling it in 99 years. So these are big changes. This is a big, profound, terrible thing happened in the world, even though it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, as I'll get to in a minute. Let me get to the next one here. This is Latin America from 1960 to 80 and from 80 to 2000. Pretty drastic change. Just income, the growth of income per person, cumulative. So 82% growth rate during this period for Latin America and the Caribbean as a region, and 9% from 90 to 2000. Now this is different from the, from 1980 to 2000. This is a little different from the other graph because this is looking at the same group of countries, but nonetheless, it's still a profound change, so drastic that it's had an enormous political impact. Let's take a look at the decade by decade. You can see it this way as well. You can see even the 50s were okay, the 60s and 70s. And the 60s and 70s were not great by world standards. They were just very good. But not compared to the Asian countries, for example, which grew much faster, the successful Asian countries. And South Korea, for example, much faster than this. But you can see what happened. The 80s was called the lost decade. Negative growth, 7% negative growth of income per person. And a terrible disaster. Then the 90s, you have growth, but it's only about half the rate of the previous decades. And here we are, more than half of the current decade is over, and we've got only 1% growth per capita, despite the fact that last year was pretty good. So it doesn't look good for this decade. This is probably going to be another really bad decade. And for Latin America, it's almost certain, as a matter of fact, and as compared to the past. And just, again, to emphasize the difference this makes, you know, Brazil would have European living standards today if it had just continued to grow at its rate that it grew prior to 1980. And Mexico doubled its income in the first period and has not grown very much since 1980 by comparison, very, very little compared to the first period. And so these are big changes, and they're providing a lot of, I'd say they're causing political revolts throughout the region. You've had now several elections in just the last 6 or 7 years in Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador, Uruguay, and now you have the leading candidate. He's got a 10-point lead in Mexico for next year's election, is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is running also against what they call neoliberalism and talking about the 25 years of economic failure. Now, in all these cases, presidential candidates actually ran specifically on this issue, said that there had been a long-term economic failure, and whether they did it or not, they pledged to find a new way, a new economic model of some sort. And I think this is just going to continue to happen because people just don't live this long indefinitely with so little economic progress. But here, you don't really hear much about this. I actually did a Nexus search prior to coming here, and for all the articles in the last 5 years that at least mentioned this growth failure in Latin America or worldwide. You wouldn't expect necessarily them to do the kind of summing up that we did for the world, but the press has been reporting on the electoral changes and political unrest in Latin America for several years now. And there's only been, in the 5 years, 25 articles total in the major press, including the British press, which probably had most of them, or a good part of them, that actually describe this, or mention it, you know. And actually, out of the 25, about 16 were from CIPR. Either written by us or reporters that interviewed us for the articles. In the New York Times, there were a couple of those. And so you really, it just has not gotten to the radar screen. And as you'll see on our website, we wrote another paper just a couple weeks ago where these graphs are mostly taken from, the called the Scorecard on Development, 25 Years of Diminished Progress. We wrote one 5 years ago that was, the subtitle was 20 Years of Diminished Progress. The question is, are we going to have to write another one at 30 years? That remains to be seen. Okay, before the media starts to really take notice of what's going on here. Now, as you would expect, because of the growth is so important to human well-being, you would expect to see a decline in progress also on things like health outcomes and education. And we don't have measures of everything that you would expect to see changes in. It would be good if we had some measure of environmental degradation as well, but we don't. So we looked at the data that is available, and you do see this. This is life expectancy at birth. And again, the countries are divided into quintile. Across the top, you can see the ages, the life expectancy range. So the bottom group is countries where people started the 1960s with a life expectancy in the 31 to 44 range. And the next bar over is the ones that started in 1980 in that range. And by the way, at the bottom of the graph, I haven't mentioned, but you see the number of countries in each period. Now this changes. In these graphs, it mainly changes because there's progress in the first period. So you see a different grouping. More towards the higher end, for example, you see 50 groups, 50 countries in the top 69 to 76 range in the 1980 to 2000, what does it go to? 2002 for this data, and only 16 countries in that range in the first period, right? So there's progress in the first period and some progress in the second period, but you, because of the progress in the first period, you see the country numbers change. In the very first graph we looked at, you had different numbers in the different groups for that reason, and also because there are some countries for which data is only available from 1980 to 2005. Yes?
I was curious in that first graph whether the difference in the number of countries made a difference in terms of the skewing.
No, actually, we did look at it. Well, he wants to know. Here in this first graph, we're flipping back to it, looking at the growth of the countries between in the two periods in just per capita income, and whether or not it made a difference, whether you included all the countries for which there's only data after 1980, you know, and whether you did include it. In fact, we did it both ways. The more fair way is to include all the data, and so that's what you see in this graph. But if you take them out, it doesn't change the story, except for the bottom quintile no longer shows an improvement. Yes?
On that same graph, what happens if, because the last column is, there's like $33,000 different, 9,000 to 43,000.
Yes.
What happens if you split it, you know, 9,000 to 25,000?
Well, we didn't do that. Yes. So the question is, on the highest quintile from 9,000 to 43,700, what happens if you split it up between the high-income countries, like European level would be about 20,000, for example, and up and below that. And, yeah, there is a difference. I think I mentioned it earlier. You do most of that reduction is really from the middle-income countries. And not as much. But there was a slowdown in the high-income countries, too, and it was significant. And people have written about that as well, and we can talk about that in the discussion. I'm going to try and go through it. Go ahead and interrupt, though, too, if you have those kinds of questions to clarify the presentation. It's fine. So here we are at life expectancy, and you can see a decline in all of these groups significant decline. Again, on the vertical axis, what you have is how many years of additional life are added per year over the period. So, for instance, for that fourth quintile, the second from the bottom, if you had to improve at the rate of the first period, the 0.57 or so years of life expectancy per year, you would have about a 12-year improvement in the second period in life expectancy rather than less than a year. So it's a big difference. And you can see the differences are significant in all the groups except the top group went the other way. And that's, again, mostly driven by the rich countries. You see similar results for mortality, adult mortality. And here it's a little bit more mixed. You can see the bottom three quintiles. Yeah, they're arranged in order of best to worst on this one. It's the opposite direction, increasing mortality per thousand. So the right-hand side has the worst cases. And in the bottom three from the right, you see a worsening in the rate of progress and, in fact, an actual increase in mortality in those two quintiles from the right. And the mortality data is split into male and female. They don't have a total number, but the story is similar for female mortality. If you look at child mortality, again, arranged from left to right, you have, again, a slowdown in the rate of progress pretty much across the board. Increasing, of course, in the poor countries with the higher rates of child mortality. Similar picture for infant mortality. Again, very significant decline in the rate of progress. Public spending on education also declines pretty much across the board. The top quintile is not as important because some of that is demographic change in the higher income countries and even some middle income countries where you don't have to spend as much on education because your school age population has declined. But you can still see a decline in public spending on education. And on education outcomes, this is a measure of primary school enrollment. Again, it's just looking at how many children are enrolled as a percentage of the age of the population that should be enrolled. That's why you can go over 100 if you have remedial reading and literacy classes on the right-hand side. And you can see this picture is a little bit more mixed, but still declines in the bottom two quintiles. And secondary school enrollment also declines across the board in all groups of countries. Yes? Okay, that's the percentage of... Yeah, what are the numbers on top of the graph? The numbers across the top show if you take the total population of people who are the age where they should be in secondary school, what percentage of them are enrolled. So it ranges from 1 to 6 in the bottom quintile to 69 to 126 in the top quintile. Okay, yes. Yes, sorry. Okay, so that's infant mortality rate per thousand. The question is, what does the top of the graph show these ranges? So on the left-hand side, you have countries, the richer countries here, with infant mortality rates between 6 and 29 per thousand. And it goes all the way out to a range of 145 to 218 per thousand. These are infants who die before the age of one. Well, these are not percentages. These are rates with all... Yeah, for the enrollment rates, it's the same reason that I gave before, that the reason it goes over to 100% is because you have both secondary school and primary school classes that are for adults that are beyond the age, the normal age group. And the decline in those, by the way, in that top category is not necessarily a bad thing. You can just have fewer people who are in need of that as time goes on. So... it's really the other four quintiles that matter for those. Okay. Now, to get to some of the possible explanations, there are a lot. A lot of things could have gone wrong. I just thought I would show just one set of policy mistakes that are in fairly recent memory that's, you know, people here might have read about in the newspapers even when they were happening, although some of them weren't even described in the newspapers. As you'll see in a minute. The first one was, look what happened to Argentina from the second half of 1998 through 2002. There was a depression. And you can see that on the graph. That trend line is drawn pretty modestly based on fairly slow growth in the past. It goes back to 87, so there's some bad years in there. So nothing's exaggerated. Also, you can just see where it peaks at 100. So that's 1998 is where it's drawn. The 1998 equals 100. Look at how far they lost, you know, almost 23% of their income per person in these 4 years. It was quite a disaster in Argentina. And... you know, the majority of the population fell below the poverty line in a country that really had fairly recently the highest among the highest living standards in Latin America. And so it's pretty easy to tell the story here, you know, of the policy mistakes that contributed to this disaster. Probably the worst was the continued maintenance of the convertibility system, which was where the Argentine peso was pegged to the U.S. dollar at a one-to-one rate. It became overvalued, especially as the dollar became overvalued. And then you had a series of financial crises in the world that caused outflows of capital and instability in Argentina, starting with the Federal Reserve raising interest rates in 94 to 95, which caused the Mexican peso crisis. And then there was the Asian financial crisis, the Russian crisis, and then it spread to Brazil. And each time, Argentina was just kind of caught in a trap because of the policies they had adopted, the fixed currency, the free movement of capital in and out of the country, the convertibility system, which meant when the capital went out of the country, it actually shrank the money supply in the country. So that, then they adopted high interest rates and budget cutting, partly as requirements for support from the IMF and the World Bank, which, by the way, had a major role in this particular failure, although they kind of try to deny it now and say it was all the Argentine government's fault. But it had quite an impact on people there in terms of their attitude towards the United States. One of my favorite stories, which I saw on TV there was a show there called Caiga Quien Caiga, which means kind of let chips fall where they may, and Michael Moore type of camera work where they follow people around who don't necessarily want to be on camera, and they went after the IMF rep at the time, who was Anup Singh, and they confronted him in his hotel room and with a set of plastic vampire teeth and said, "Excuse me, we think we found these in the back of President Duhalde's neck, and we think they belong to you." Attitudes towards the United States really plummeted there because they did see, and that's not to say that was it was entirely just the IMF and the World Bank, but another policy that contributed to this as well was promoted by both of them, and that was the privatization of their Social Security system, which took a lot of revenue. In fact, the lost revenue from privatizing the Social Security system in Argentina was accounts for, and plus the lost interest from that accounts for virtually the entire budget, federal budget deficit of Argentina, all the way to 2001. So that's one of the reasons why we didn't do that here, because nobody could come up with a way to replace the lost revenue when you privatize, when you create individual accounts or privatize the system. So anyway, that's just one example. I could, you know, go on for a long time, but again, you know, you can see policy mistakes contributed to that. Russia. Now, here's one where I couldn't, I have not seen in you know, the last 10 years any articles in the, I think there was one in the Washington Post that really described and talked about this particular growth disaster. And this is the worst in probably the history of the world without a war or a natural calamity of some sort. You don't find anything quite this bad. You know, over 40% drop in per capita GDP. You had the poverty, number of people in poverty in Russia increased from something like 2 million to 60 million. Massive, terrible disaster. And very little, I mean, there's been very little in the press here in describing it. You know, and here again, there it's not hard to see some of the policy mistakes. You can argue about it. Obviously, there was a transition taking place. And some people would say, well, that's just the inevitable cost of transition to a market economy. But then there was right next door China, which seemed to manage this transition while having the highest rate of growth in world history. So clearly, the counterfactual shouldn't be set so low. And in fact, this is a low trend line we have on there. That's based on the 1980s growth, which was a very bad decade for the old Soviet Union and for Russia. And so you see there was a huge drop-off. And look, they're just now this year reaching the level of income per person that they had back in 1990. So quite dramatic. Some of the policy mistakes that it's, I think you can identify in retrospect. They rapidly decontrolled prices. In 3 months, they had a 520% inflation rate. Then they slammed on the brakes and caused a depression with monetary policy and fiscal policy. And they had a very rapid privatization. About three quarters of the industry was in non-state hands within a couple of years. And they had, the people, the architects of this transition seemed to think that you just had to basically get rid of the existing industrial productive infrastructure and just get foreign investment to replace it. And of course, that the foreign direct investment never came. So there were a whole series of mistakes that really plunged this country into a state where most of the transactions a few years ago, well, as late as probably 98, were taking place in barter, through barter. And you notice, by the way, it didn't really pick up until the final part of the old system of reforms, which was the fixed exchange rate. The ruble was tied to the dollar. That collapsed in 98, and that's where you see finally the economy begins to grow again. So definitely, again, people could argue about what is the counterfactual, what some of the changes are obviously good. Some privatizations are good, for example. Some openings to trade are good for the economy in all of these cases, right? But clearly, some set of reforms was introduced in a way that was extremely harmful. Asian financial crisis, another example. These countries were in better shape and recovered a lot faster. Although not Indonesia, as you can see, it was fairly recent that they got back to their 1996 or 97 pre-crisis level of per capita GDP. They were hurt very badly, and that's a big country too. But the overall, again, policy mistakes. You had a decontrol. I think this is even recognized now by some of the people responsible for these policies. The liberalization of capital flows, which was they made it very easy for a lot of hot money to rush into the country. About 11% of GDP went right out of the countries, out of these countries, in 1 year, and so that was a big contributor. And then you had a series of policy mistakes, including extremely high interest rates in response to the crisis, that made it worse. So again, that's another example. But you know, these examples are just a few, and there are ones in the 90s, the 80s in Latin America is, of course, a worse example. I think what you'd have to do is go country by country, because they're all different stories, but I think they all do involve policy mistakes, and they're not the same ones either. Some of them are, and some of them aren't. Although one could argue that some of them are driven by similar theories, preferences, powerful interests, multilateral institutions, and so on. But there are different stories that contributed to this big slowdown in economic growth. Okay, and here are the big exceptions. China and India, and these are countries which together have close to half of the population of the developing world. And they did much better in the second period, China especially. This graph doesn't completely dramatize it. The 7.1% growth rate in the 1980 to 2005 period for China translates into a six-fold increase in per capita income over that period, one of the most successful one of the fastest periods of growth in history. And India also did pretty well, doubling its growth rate in the second period. Now, sometimes people point to this, and there's two arguments that you hear. You know, one is, well, this is most of the developing world, so we've had a big success. And there's a couple things wrong with this argument. One is, from a policy point of view, if you have a set of reforms that's introduced into 80 or 90 countries or however many, and it succeeds in two or three or four or five, you know, that's not a success, even if the two of the countries happen to be really big. I mean, we're lucky in that sense that these two countries did well. But on the other hand, the second thing that's wrong with the argument that this is an example of the success of the reforms of the last 25 years is that the story is a very different story than what happened in most of the low and middle income countries in terms of reforms. And here's just a short list of some of the differences. You see China liberalized trade after it could compete in world markets as late as 1992. They still had an average tariff over 40%. That was about four times the rate that Latin America had before it started liberalizing in the 70s. So that's one thing they did. They had a very gradual and careful transition. They used pilot projects and special enterprise zones in the 1980s to see what would work and what didn't. To experiment with foreign capital and technology. And they had a gradual liberalization of prices, by the way, not the total decontrol that you had in the shock therapy of the former Soviet Union. So there were a lot of policies that were very different. They didn't dismantle the state sector either. As late as 1996, you still had 75% of urban employment was in the state-owned and collective enterprises, and even today, I think it's still about a third, and of the urban jobs are about a third of the urban jobs are still state and collective enterprises, and they were careful about it, and they avoided a lot of the mistakes. They still, of course, protected their economy, controlled the exchange rate, very strict controls over currency flow still today, even though they decided to, you know, a few months ago to make a marginal change in the value of their currency. It's still very strict controls over their currency, which again may not work in other countries. Clearly the fixed exchange rates in the other countries we just went through didn't work, but it worked for them. So that's the, and you know, we at CEPR don't have a formula. We're not like the IMF and the World Bank. We don't say, you know, this is what a country should do. Because, you know, I especially believe that it really is different. You know, what policies succeed? I mean, look at exchange rate policy, for example. That's one of the most basic questions of macroeconomic policy. And there's still no real clear, there's no agreement among economists, and there's no clear indication for most economists, at least, of what the best exchange rate policy is. It really is going to depend on other things. But we can go into more of that later. I should just wind this up. Some of the other things that were different, their banking system is still dominated by state-owned banks controlling 60% of it. The government actually uses and shapes foreign investment in accordance with these development goals. They have all kinds of performance requirements on them, some of which are now being prohibited in the WTO agreement. So these are the kind of things that made it China very different. India also, I won't go into, but it was not the story that you sometimes hear, that they just opened up their economy and then they started to grow. In fact, in both China and India, their growth spurt started about 10 years before the major trade liberalization. It was in the early 80s. And India also has still a very protected economy and currency controls and other things that were not allowed in the other countries that adopted reform. So again, it's very hard to hold these up, although it's often done, as examples of why the reforms of the last 25 years were a success. So what's the conclusion? Well, first, our modest task to point to the obvious, that nobody's talking about the sharp slowdown in economic growth in the vast majority of low and middle income countries. Second, that this has very important and severe social and human consequences. And this is something I think a lot of people who are trying to change the world for the better don't necessarily realize, that most of the reduction in social progress that we've seen or in the last 25 years are really due to the growth slowdown and not to any increases in inequality, which may have taken place as well. And finally, we think that economists and policymakers and the press as well should be trying to figure out what went wrong over the last 25 years and not simply think about how to continue implementing the same policies as much as possible. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks.